Okay. Okay, let's start. Today's topic is ethics, ethics in research, ethics in scientific conduct. It will be a rather short lecture, only an hour or so. I don't know how many of you are students at the Interaction Design Master. So there is a few. I would like you to stay also for the second hour, because I'll give some introduction to the project you're going to start up. You may have seen something on Blackboard already on that. So I'll also make a recording for those who are not here, so it should be possible to follow. But for the first topic, what do we mean by research ethics? So it's very few of these other stuff I'm going to talk about now is considered as, you could say, strict rules. Mainly we are discussing guidelines or things to think about when we do research, things we should try to avoid doing when we do research. It covers a number of different areas. It can be about how we treat people that we do research on, participants in research, which maybe are some of the most important things when it comes to doing sound research or on sound ethical grounds. It has to do with informed consent, how we people are aware of what they're taking part in. And it has to do with privacy issues, privacy and anonymity. But in addition to that, you have some issues that has to do with scientific misconduct, meaning how you treat data, avoid faking data, avoid ignoring data that don't fit your message, what you want to write in your science. But also issues on that area that has to do with failing to report dependencies, your own dependencies in different ways. Who funds your research? Where are you employed, for instance? Finally, it has to do with how you treat other researchers, previous research, or colleagues in your research. There are also issues that has to do with the consequences of research, because research is, as we may have mentioned before, not or very seldom completely apolitical. It's part of a society, it's part of a system, and your conclusions, what you point at, may have consequences for others in some way. Now, why are we concerned about research ethics? Well, it is because in the name of science, a lot of bad stuff has been done through the history. And these two points on this slide has only to do with some landmarks on legislation on scientific practices. And of course, this was something that was done after World War II, where a lot of experiments, especially really bad treatment of humans, was conducted in the name of science. So, right after World War II, we got the Nuremberg Code, where some standards were set up for how researchers, in this context, medical researchers more than anything, biological research, should be treated, or how people should be treated. This was taken further into the Helsinki Declaration in 1964, where 18 ethical principles for, in this case again, medical research, but this has been the basis for a lot of the research guidelines we have, was put down. And some of these, on these, in the Helsinki Declaration, a couple of the important words that we're using today, important principles that we're using today, was also mentioned, like informed consent and voluntary participation in experimentation. People should be aware of what they are taking part of and should be capable of understanding what they're part of. Why is it important? You could say over time, also way after World War II, a lot of research has been done that has raised a lot of debate on ethics. Was this the right thing to do? Was it worth it? Why should it be done? Why shouldn't it have been done? We have very clear violations of that that are used as examples in a lot of debates. I don't know if you heard about something called the Tessoji syphilis experiment or syphilis study. It was an American study where they followed a number of poor black American people with black American poor people coming from the countryside in America, who had syphilis, or who were diagnosed with syphilis at an early stage. I think this was back in the 30s or 40s. And these patients, they were interested in how did syphilis develop in a normal way. And these patients were then followed up in some 20 years until the 1960s, mid-60s, I think, where treatment of syphilis was more or less standard medical procedures. We've got antibiotics. This was very poor. It was very cheap as well, so everybody could be treated. But these patients were not informed about the treatment and carried on being more and more sick, of course. And this was absolutely a violation of... they weren't aware they were part of the study and stuff like that. So it was kind of an obvious break of ethical standards. But there are more subtle things and things that has raised debate that may also be used as examples of some of the dilemmas that you have when you are discussing or being confronted with ethics in research. I'm taking extremes. You're not going to be conducting anything similar to stuff like this, of course. But you should be aware of some of these considerations. I'll go more into the softer things later, but I'll just give you an example. This is a famous study which some of you may have heard about. Stanley Milgram's study on obedience and individual responsibility, done in late 1960s, 68, I think, 67, where Stanley Milgram wanted to check how far normal people were willing to go in punishing other people when they were under the influence of a some kind of a teacher. This was a reference to who could do the very violent crimes under World War II, for instance. So why could ordinary people do this? Well, could it be explained by the presence of a very strong manipulator or a teacher, an authority? So in this experiment, volunteers were invited and maybe paid a little bit to participate in a study where they were told that they were either given the role as a teacher or as the other participant, the one who's going to be taught something. He was just an actor in this case. So this is typically an experiment that you will see in psychology and in other contexts, and we'll get back to called deceptive research. We create a story that hasn't really to do with the what we're after in this case. So the task is then that the teacher here, the participant in the study that's given the role as a teacher, he is given the role of giving electrical shocks to the learner, in this case, who is given tasks, quite simple tasks, mathematical tasks, I think they used, that he was going to answer. And now and then he gave wrong answers. And every time he gave the wrong answer, the Stanley Milgram, in his white overall, in his laboratory suit, as an authority figure, told the participant in his study to give an electrical shock to the learner. And every time the learner answered wrongly, well, he should increase the shock. So every time he increased the shock, one level up. And this was done in an instrument that you can see on the bottom here, where there were switches that he was going to press, and then there were some markings above the switches going from weak to very strong to possibly lethal, and there were some red markings underneath. So what Milgram was after was how many is willing to go to the end of this scale. It's a quite extreme task he's giving there. And of course, well, what happens is that the learner here, he screams, stop, 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 don't do this anymore. Just all these things. You can search this experiment on the net and find the some sound clips from the experiment. Well, it's just fake, of course. It's not been given any shocks. But the thing is, the teacher in this case, a lot of them, in this case, in the initial study, some 65% were actually willing to go all the way up into the red zone and give possibly lethal shocks to the learners. And what we saw, and what they also saw, and what Milgram wasn't actually aware of in the beginning, was that some of these participants, well, they were just sent out, and they broke completely. They had a mental breakdown right afterwards. So the discussion is this an ethical experiment? Can it be an ethical experiment? Well, you really didn't... one thing, you didn't inform the participants of their role or of the purpose of the study, so you can't say you had informed consent. You you went pretty far into creating a situation which was very bad for the participants here. So, is it ethical? Well, we can get back to it and look at what considerations that we could have done here. The first principle is the principle of voluntary participation, and that has to do with, you could say, respect for a person's autonomy in some way. A participant in any study, and this is a general rule, the general guideline, should be informed of all the aspects of the research that they take part in. Not only that, they should also be informed about a freedom to decline participation. So there should be a little pressure, and at any time during a study, you should be able to withdraw from the study. Milgram didn't do anything of this. Some considerations when we talk about informed consent has to do with the competence an individual have when it comes to giving informed consent and participate in a study. Kids with limited language, with limited understanding of things, are considered generally not competent in taking their own decisions on subjects like this, and should be consent should then be done by informing parents, for instance. That's an obvious thing. But there are more subtle things like knowledge about language and skills. If you invite people with a very technical language, where people aren't really in a position to understand what's taking place, may also create difficulties here. And this is a situation some of you may come into when you are inviting people. You talk about, you use technical wordings, you use create situations that your test subjects don't really understand. And that may create difficulties on when it comes to informed consent and voluntary participation. But of course, a lot of studies are more difficult, like in, let's go back to Milgram's example. He couldn't have done this. He couldn't have gotten to the findings that he got to by actually informing about all the stuff that's going to take place, and probably not even if he told them that he could withdraw at any point. Because the pressure was the point of the experiment. Much less important, or much less, could say, serious are situations that you may create, or at least some of you may create, where you are putting people, we're looking at how people react to different types of information. If you tell them what they should expect, well, then they probably won't show the behavior that you are after. Let's say you want to see how, if you can fool people into give away their passwords, for instance, if you can create situations where they, where you can create fraud-like situations, well, you can't tell them that's what you're after, because then you have destroyed the whole situation. So you have to think of this as a general guideline, a consideration you have to do, and there are ways around it. There are ways to handle this. In in experimentation where you have control groups, for instance, and groups that gets you could say similar treatment to the experimental group. Well, you can inform people that they're either part of the experimental group or the control group. I can't tell you which group you're part of. Well, then you have informed them about this. So there are ways around it, and there are things you should do in the continuation to handle this in a better way. This way of doing experiments and this somewhat challenging situation is often called deceptive research where we fool people a little bit. And the maybe most important thing to do in situations where we have a possibility for, or you say, where you have some kind of a hoax involved, where you have some kind of a where you have withheld information to the test subject, debriefing is somewhat the word to use around it. Tell them about it afterwards. Create an interview situation. Tell them about all what happened here. Tell them about the stimuli material they were given compared to the control group, for instance, so that you actually create a situation that's more pleasant for the test subject and explain it to him afterwards. So the general rule is don't do deceptive research if you can avoid it, but if you have to do it, well, make sure that you have a debriefing situations. Milgram did this in the end. He created a good debriefing situations and tried to normalize what people were doing afterwards, telling them that what you did now was something that a lot of people do, and stuff like that, just to take down how dramatic the situation was. So you may have difficulties, of course, in situations where you don't have direct contact with participants, like on the internet, for instance. And there are special things to consider in those situations as well. I will in a while point you to a few sources for this type of guidelines and information that goes a bit further. You will find that electronically in the Blackboard file as well, some guidelines from the Norwegian Research Ethical Committees. That it's several committees on different areas that have made these types of guidelines for conducting ethically sound research. So it's there are ways to handle this. One of the most important things when you consider whether you should do deceptive research or whether you should create situations that may be difficult for a participant in a study has to do with what we call cost-benefit. What's the English word? Avveininger. How we consider considerations on cost-benefit. So this is, of course, an obvious discussion on the study of Milgram study. The reason that this is not used solely as an example of bad ethical research is that it was so important to do it. The findings were extremely important. you probably won't find things that's this important, but it may be in situations where you consider the consequences of what you're after so important for society or for the field that you're studying, that it may be reasonable to do it anyway. But again, considerations of this type. So you should always do this type of cost-benefit considerations. But it doesn't necessarily have to do with harming individuals. So mental harm, like what was inflected in Milgram's study, is not the only type of cost, you could say, on individuals in a study. Well, for instance, stealing time. Well, maybe in your spare time that's not an important thing. But if you let people use a lot of time in a study, well, he invests time which may have been spent elsewhere. Of course, the obvious thing is when you do work, when you have an income. So if you require someone who is doing work that creates an income to take part in a study, well, you actually reduces his and her or her income in that time. So it should be considered. Other types of costs is that you may make people feel stupid because they can't handle the situation you put them in. Usability studies can be of that in that category, where you create situations where people that were supposed to handle a job really can't handle it with your system. So we create a situation where people comes out in the other end feeling like, well, I really shouldn't be doing this work anymore. I must be really stupid who can't do a simple task like this. So it's not only harm, it's all these softer things as well that should be part of a cost-benefit consideration. And these things are exercises that you should do when you plan an experiment or plan a study. So consider whether you can create a situation with informed consent, with where all privacy issues are handled. Consider whether you can create a situation where the benefits of the study is higher than the costs. And consider whether you can do something to reduce the costs on the participants in a study. So these are considerations you should do when you plan research. I have mentioned privacy a few times, and this is an area where some of the rules are stricter than on the other areas, which are more soft guidelines. Here you are handling situations where you're also touching on legislation. Make sure that information can't be traced back to the person that gives the information. That's the general rule. This can be done in different ways. When you do surveys, when you have invited people to take part in a survey, make sure that there are no link between the invitation and the actual responses given by the participant. In other contexts, like where you are investigating somewhat small populations, make sure that when you report data, they can't be traced back to who gave the response. This can be done much easier than one likes to think now and then. Studies within organizations, for instance. Well, 20% of the or 50% of the accounting department highly dislike their leader or their boss. If that accounting department consists of four people or two people, it's actually possible to retrace it back to them and point to them. So there are some pitfalls here, but make sure that this is handled in a good way, and you get a little bit of help in handling these kinds of stuff as well, because in general terms, when you do research in our context, in an academic context, some of the research you do, at least when you are handling information that has to do with individuals, you need to have this research reviewed in different ways before you do it. We have a review board for this in our organizations called the NSD. It's in Norwegian, Norsk Samfunnsvitenskapelig Datatjeneste. Well, it's a secretariat that where you have to register projects and have them considered whether it needs further approval, etc. So it's more or less a check-in instance where you are checking whether you need to register a project further, for instance, into some regional research ethical committees, etc. So if you search for, in Norwegian at least, I think it's called Personvernombudet for research, you will get to some of these instances. I won't show you this now. There are simple forms to fill in and stuff. You don't always have to do it. If things are, you could say, if the research you're doing is absolutely anonymous, where you actually don't handle personal information in any way, where there is a clear wall between the invitations that you send out and the responses you get, and where you don't report data in a way that makes data traceable, and if it's not sensitive information and sensitive consequences you're handling, well, you can still do it without registering your project, but in a lot of cases you should register it anyway. This is things, when you're doing research that has to do with humans, discuss this with your supervisors. And they may point this out and help you do this or follow this process through. There are some special concerns when you do things on the net, maybe mainly because of the general anonymity you may create on the net and difficulties in that context. I'm not sure if I'm going into this now, because I should. The resources that I will point out to you now is maybe a better source than a lot of the information I give you now on these issues, because they are quite concise guidelines on different areas. Can't do that there. Okay. I won't do this in the recording here now, but I can show you on in a browser here. So this won't be part of the recording I make now, but we can. I will put them as links in the Blackboard page anyway. Information to those who are only listening to the recording here. If you go to this the link that you find here, etikkom.no, You will find a lot of different guidelines for scientific conduct and how to do things. It also has a pretty good English pages. So and these are international subjects, so this is pretty much similar in all countries. A lot of countries have national committees like this who have created these types of guidelines. In this, on this site, you can find, for instance, guidelines for science and technology, which will be important for you. Some of you will do something more into social sciences. Some of you will do things that has to do with internet research, and this is a nice source to look at these things, where you also can download guidelines like the one we have here. This is for research ethics in science and technology. They're pretty fresh. There was a new version of this coming this spring. So they're updated now and then. You can also find some nice summaries here. So if you go to the summary, you can get a number of say headlines and short descriptions on what to think about when you do research. So it's a very nice source for information. One important thing here that they are highlighting, well, there are two issues we haven't talked about yet that they are highlighting a lot in several areas, both in science and technology and in internet research. And one of these issues has to do with the link between your research and society in general, the possible consequences of your research, consequences of your conclusions, stuff like that, and you could say the integrity of the researcher. So those are two issues that we will touch a little bit here. Let me get back to the presentation, which was there probably somewhere. Okay. Because there may be situations where, situations where there is some kind of, you could say, link between the researcher and the topic that he's doing research on. Some obligations or possible obligations that has to do with who funds your research, for instance. Well, that should be stated very clearly in your research. If you are submitting papers to journals, for instance, you're always asked to state all your affiliations. Who is funding projects you're part of? Who is funding the actual project you're doing now? So that we can be sure that you're not part of the story, so to say. Some of you may do... may get in situations where you do research for some organization, for a company, where the company is supporting your master thesis, for instance, and where you have them as test subjects, and or when you have their programs, their applications as test subject or as test objects. This can be handled. It's usually okay to do that. But when you do it, make sure that you say that you are part of such a situation. There are somebody backing you. There is actually a chance that a good conclusion here may result in a good job for you afterwards or something like that. So the reader knows this, and you should consider what consequences it actually have, because it could be that your conclusions are affected by situations like this. So this is also a general ethical consideration to do in research. Academic integrity also has to do with how we treat colleagues, how we treat participants. Is it okay for a professor, for instance, to write a paper or publish research that a student have been the main contributor to without including the student as writer of that paper? This may affect you. You may come in situations where results from your research is published. And in general, the one who writes out the research, the researcher, the professor, even though he's higher ranked than you are, you should also be part of the author's list of such a work. So this is just an example of considerations that has to be done. Be open on these things. There are more here on areas like this, but the final topic I'm going to cover briefly has to do with this, what we have mentioned a few times, consequences of research. Researchers can never be above society in ways. Our conclusions, the findings from research we do, can never be isolated completely from the society where it's taking place. And sometimes, there are always that's not a thing. There are always a lot of uncertainties to the conclusions that we get to. As when we do hypothesis testing, we end up with numbers in the end there. There is less than 5% chance that this occurs by chance. Well, still there is some 5% chance that there is. This has been occurring by chance. So any result has a lot of uncertainty to it. And there are also uncertainties that has to do with how we sampled the population, how we handled that part. Is the methodologies we have used good enough to actually discover what we were after? Well, probably not. There are uncertainties there as well. There are special areas where we should be extra careful before we do conclusions. Important things in society, like gender, race, religion, stuff like that. When you conclude that there are differences based on areas like this, you should be extremely careful on how you conclude and how you communicate these findings. As I said, we're not absolutely certain, and we should consider the consequences of the conclusions we make. If we say that men are much better in an area than girls are, well, could that have consequences for job selections, for selection of education, for who an employer wants to employ? When you say something about stuff like this, be extra careful. Be extra certain that your conclusions are right. Communicate the necessary uncertainties to the readers. Point out alternative explanations, weaknesses in your study. Search for them. Communicate them. An important area. Think you're not, your research may be important out there, may have consequences. Okay, that was a brief run through of ethics. I will put some more links, also a link to this, the guidelines for reporting things to this review committees for handling private information or personal information. So you will find them in Blackboard. This is the final ordinary lecture we have in this topic now. Now there will be a project period. But there will be, you will be invited and follow Blackboard. Please look into Blackboard now and then, because there will be a lecture early in or around the 10th of August now of November now, with where you're going to present the results from your project work in this area, and. In that connection, or maybe a little bit later, we will also have some kind of a summary lecture before the exam. By the way, the exam is the 9th of December. 9th of December, and it's, I think it's in the afternoon, or it's, I think it's 2 o'clock or something. It's a strange time of the day, but I think it has something to do with students from... students from other parts of the country that has to get here in the morning. So, yeah, that's it. We, I would like the students from Interaction Design to stay here for another half hour or something. Quarter past, we'll give an I'll give an intro to the to. The next project you are going to do, the IMT 4312 course on project work on human-computer interaction. Okay.
that's just a remake of the Milgram experiment.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's been done in different contexts. The scary thing is that the results can be repeated now, so it's nothing that had to do with its part in history. So it's